So this is where we are, and we'll read verses 1 through 8 here to start, chapter 20. It says, "One day as Jesus was teaching the people and preaching the good news in the temple, the leading priests, the teachers of religious law, and the elders came up to him, and they demanded, 'By what authority are you doing all these things? Who gave you the right?' 'Let me ask you a question first,' he replied. 'Did John's authority to baptize come from heaven, or was it merely human?' They talked it over among themselves. 'If we say it was from heaven, he will ask why we didn't believe John. But if we say it was merely human, the people will stone us because they are convinced John was a prophet.' So they finally replied replied that they didn't know. And Jesus responded, 'Then I won't tell you by what authority I do these things.'" And so with every section here tonight, it's kind of going to follow a similar pattern. These teachers of the law, different leaders, religious leaders, are going to ask these questions of Jesus. And their goal is not to gain information, to gain understanding, to get closer to Jesus. Their goal was to trap him. Okay? They were trying to get him to state that he was the Messiah, that he was the Son of God. And if he actually verbalized this and made that statement, they could accuse him of blasphemy and actually bring him to trial. So that was their plan with all these questions. I will just caution you, because I did this the first time I read through it. I pretty much just saw this as a bunch of arguments. And I was like, this is super uninspiring. It's just Jesus versus the Pharisees. At first glance, I wasn't seeing all the spiritual truths that Jesus had in there. So yes, they're asking these questions to trap him, but these are actually good questions. Had they been asked with a genuine heart, had they actually wanted to know and understand a little bit more. So just guard your heart on that, because I had to at first. So they ask him, "By what authority are you doing all these things? Okay, who gives you the right?" Like I said, they wanted Jesus to state that he was the Son of God. And of course, Jesus sees right through this. And instead of answering, he just asks them a question, a pretty straightforward question back to them. He says, "John the Baptist, do you think his authority was from heaven, that he was sent from God, or was it merely human?" And these guys, I imagine they like huddled up like a little football team or something. And they're like, "All right, what's our game plan?" And they discuss the options. They say, "All right, if we say that he was from heaven, Jesus is going to say, 'Then how come you didn't listen to him?' Okay. If they say that he was just here on his own authority, speaking on his own authority, they were risking upsetting the people. And it says that they would probably likely stone them, because these people were convinced that John was a prophet from God. So they deliberate, they break their huddle, they come back to Jesus and say, "We don't know." Okay, "We don't know," was their answer. Okay, all these guys were smart, well-esteemed, well-educated, religious leaders, and they could not answer a simple question about John the Baptist. Okay, they couldn't form an opinion. And Jesus says, "Fine, if you can't give me an answer, I'm not going to give you an answer." So I think Jesus really wants us to be upfront and honest on where we stand today. Okay, again, he's kind of fighting battles here with the Pharisees, but I think today Jesus wants you to be clear in your heart where you stand. Okay, not that we have everything figured out, not that we understand the Bible or have it all memorized, but he wants us to have a firm opinion about who Jesus is, who he is to you. Okay, he doesn't want us hanging somewhere in the middle. If any of you have read Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, it's a great book. I would recommend it. But there's a quote in here that kind of ties this idea together, so I'm just going to read this whole paragraph. But what he says is, "I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. Hey, that is the one thing that we must not say. A man who is merely a man and said the sort of things that Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with the man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. And you must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman, or something worse. And you can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us, and he did not intend to. And so I think that sums it up really well, that you got to decide, who is Jesus to you today? Because he's either everything, he's the full package, he's your Savior, he's your Lord, he's your Father, he's your friend, or he's really nothing. Okay, because you take any part out of who Jesus is, if you don't believe he's Son of God, it doesn't add up. What he did in the Bible here, it doesn't add up without any of those pieces missing. So we don't get to choose anything in between. It's either Jesus who he fully is or not. In Revelation 3, again, he kind of reiterates this idea. He says, I know all the things you do, that you are neither hot nor cold. I wish that you were one of them. But since you are like lukewarm water, neither hot nor cold, I will spit you out of my mouth. Okay, so this is pretty strong imagery here that Jesus will spit you out. Okay, he wants nothing to do with just you kind of with your toes in the water, kind of following him, but not really. Okay, off again, on again. It sounds like to me, and I think this is true, that he'd rather have you be completely cold. Okay, because if we're somewhere in the middle, we might think we're good, we might think we're experiencing God, but we're not. And we'll never have a chance to truly turn to him because we don't know where we stand. Let's keep reading here. In verse 9, it says, Now Jesus turned to the people again and told them this story. A man planted a vineyard, leased it to tenant farmers, and moved to another country to live for several years. At the time of the grape harvest, he sent one of his servants to collect his share of the crop. But the farmers attacked the servant, beat him up, and sent him back empty-handed. So the owner sent another servant, but they also insulted him, beat him up, and sent him away empty-handed. A third man was sent, and they wounded him and chased him away. What will I do? The owner asked himself. I know, I'll send my cherished son. Surely they will respect him. But when the tenant farmers saw his son, they said to each other, Here comes the heir to the estate, this estate. Let's kill him and get the estate for ourselves. So they dragged him out of the vineyard and murdered him. What do you suppose the owner of the vineyard will do to them? Jesus asked. I will tell you. He will come and kill those farmers and lease the vineyard to others. How terrible that such a thing should ever happen, his listeners protested. And Jesus looked at them and said, Then what does this scripture mean? The stone that the builders rejected has now become the cornerstone. Everyone who stumbles over that stone will be broken to pieces, and it will crush anyone it falls on. The teachers of religious law and the leading priests wanted to arrest Jesus immediately because they realized he was telling the story against them. They were the wicked farmers, but they were afraid of the people's reaction. All right, we'll stop there. So Jesus tells this parable of these wicked farmers. And maybe you picked up on who some of these characters represent, but I'm just going to do a full breakdown of all the characters here. So first we got the vineyard, and this represents Israel. Okay, think Old Testament Israel. God is the owner of the vineyard, right? Israel is God's chosen people. The evil tenant farmers, these are the religious leaders. Okay, they were the ones sent. They're supposed to keep up the vineyard. They were supposed to guide and help lead Israel towards God, help them follow God's commands. Then you have the servants. The prophets and priests that God sent to Israel. Okay, again, think Old Testament in the Bible here. God continually sends priests and prophets into Israel, but they are often rejected and murdered. They're not listened to. And so finally, he's now kind of predicting here. He says he'll send the owner's son, which is Jesus, into the vineyard, into the world. And they ultimately will kill Jesus. They'll reject him and kill him. And it says, the wicked farmers will be killed and will be leased out to others. And the others here would be the Gentiles. Okay, so Christ comes, and this new covenant is open to everybody. Okay, we're Gentiles today. We're the others. So Christ came and died for us. And so this parable actually does kind of answer the previous question in a way. He sets himself up to be the owner that is sent into, the owner's son who is sent into the vineyard, kind of proclaiming like, hey, I came from the big guy, the boss. Okay, I'm his son. It also reveals that Jesus is very aware of their plot to kill him. Okay, so Jesus kind of has this way of saying a lot without saying much, and people obviously picked up on it. It said by the end here that they were enraged because they realized he was talking about them. And so Jesus frequently does this. Back in chapter 11 of Luke 11, he kind of doubles down on the same idea. He says, what sorrow awaits you, for you build monuments for the prophets your own ancestors killed long ago. But in fact, you stand as witnesses who agree with what your ancestors did. They killed the prophets, and you join in their crime by building the monuments. And so Jesus here, he's being really straightforward. Okay, I imagine it was kind of a, let's cut all the BS here, everything that's been going on. All you've ever done is reject me. Okay, your ancestors did it with the prophets. You guys are doing the exact same thing now. This is a tale told over and over again with them. Okay, and Jesus, I'm sure in righteous anger, is just confronting them. And I'm sure he's just had it up to here, but he keeps it cool. He does not ever like lash out. But the Pharisees, these guys thought that they had it going on. Okay, they had built up this religion that they were at the top of. Okay, they thought that they were doing everything right. They probably looked up to their ancestors. And like Jesus said, they backed up what they did. And Jesus enters the picture, and he just kind of messes it all up. Okay, everything that they had, everything that they had been working towards and building, Jesus is saying, this is wrong. Okay, you guys have never had this quite right. It's always been off. And he's confronting it. And they won't have it. Okay, they're going to fight tooth and nail. That's why they're trying so hard to get him arrested. That's why they're trying so hard to get him killed. It's because Jesus is a threat to them now. Jesus quotes Psalm 118 at the end of this section. He says, the stone in which the builders rejected has now become the cornerstone. Now, since ancient times, cornerstones have been this piece of a building, okay? The main structural component, it was normally the principal stone, the largest, the most solid, is normally put, as you might have guessed, in the corner. Okay, once the cornerstone was set, it became the basis for determining every measurement. Okay, once the cornerstone was set, everything kind of had to be guided by where that was placed. And so Jesus was always intended to be this cornerstone. Okay, if you try to do religion, if you try to, you know, memorize your Bible, do everything you can to just be a good, outstanding Christian, and you're missing a relationship with Jesus, you're missing the most structurally important part of your faith. Okay, it won't work. It doesn't matter how many mission trips you do, how many verses you have memorized, how many of these services you come to. Okay, it doesn't matter how long you've been going to church. It will never be enough without Jesus at the center. I'm sure some of you were around, but you know the old Cedar Corp building? It was like an architectural firm. It's right across from Burger King and Believer City Church. Huge building. But before that, they had an old building that was torn down a few years ago. Okay, it wasn't the cornerstone that failed in this building, but it was some sort of central structural beam, from my understanding. Something that as soon as it fell, and it just randomly collapsed one day. Okay, I understand that they were just like working, going about their business, and the structure just collapsed. And they had to evacuate immediately. And that building just sat there for, felt like forever. I feel like it was like a year. And no one was allowed in it. No work was getting done inside. And you walk by this building, it looked totally fine. Okay, they evacuated so fast that all of their plants and like knickknacks were still in the window. It looked like a functioning building. And you would never have guessed that it was condemned. Okay, something was off with the foundation. Something was misaligned. It was no longer useful, okay? Even though it looked the part, it was functional for a long time. Okay, if you're not getting it, this could be you, okay? You're the building that's going to collapse if you don't have the cornerstone in place, if you don't have Jesus at the center. And you look at the Pharisees, all that they had done. I mean, they built this huge, beautiful building, okay? They had fancy robes. They had fancy temples. It said they prayed long prayers. People looked up to them. It was a big, beautiful building that represented their religion. But it was skewed from the beginning. Okay, they did not have Jesus. They rejected that cornerstone. And so it's all collapsing. And Jesus is starting to do the collapsing here. Okay, he's coming in and he's shutting down how they've been living, how they've been operating. In 1 Corinthians 3:11, it says, "For no one can lay any foundation other than the one we already have, Jesus Christ." Okay, so it doesn't matter what you replace it with, okay? And it might be church, it might be reading your Bible, it might be you go on every mission trip or you play on the worship team, whatever it is. Anything that you're resting on that's not Jesus is going to fail. It's not going to hold up. It might look fine, it might go undetected, but it's not going to hold up. And so Jesus says, regarding the stone here, he says he's the stone rejected, he becomes the cornerstone. And the people here did ultimately reject Jesus. Okay, if you remember last week, he gets kind of the red carpet treatment, or the green palm treatment. It's commonly known as Palm Sunday. Okay, Jesus is victorious, coming into Jerusalem on the colt. Okay, people are praising him, hailing him as king. This feels like, you know, the coming Messiah is here. He's here to restore things. And everybody was backing him. And just days later, the same people are shouting to crucify him. That's quite the flip here. But all of this said, the wicked farmers, the stone rejected, it was starting to become real clear that the leaders were going to do this, that they were going to try to kill him, that they were going to try to trap him. And they realized that Jesus knows, okay? It says that they're enraged because they realize these stories were about them. So let's keep reading here. In verse 20, it says, "Watching for their opportunity, the leader sent spies pretending to be honest men. They tried to get Jesus to say something that would be reported to the Roman governor so he would arrest Jesus. 'Teacher,' they said, 'we know that you speak and teach what is right and are not influenced by what others think. You teach the way of God truthfully. Now tell us, is it right for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not?' And he saw through their trickery and said, 'Show me a Roman coin. Whose picture and title are stamped on it?' 'Caesar's,' they replied. 'Well then,' he said, 'give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and give to God what belongs to God.' So they failed to trap him by what he said in front of the people. Instead, they were amazed by his answer, and they became silent." So they switch up their tactic a little bit. They send people in pretending to be honest. Okay, they say, "We know that you speak and teach what is right. You're not influenced by what others think. Okay, you teach truthfully." They think that they can like puff up Jesus or trick him just by flattering him. And they clearly don't know who they're dealing with, or they haven't seen how this has gone down previously. Because again, Jesus sees right through it. But the question's fair. Okay, they ask, "Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar?" And no, this is not a question about whether you can skip doing taxes. It's really about submitting to human authority. Okay, the heart of this question is, do we owe this human government any sort of allegiance? If we belong to God, if he's our king, You know, what are we doing paying into this other system? Why are we supporting anything else? Now, the Bible is pretty clear, extremely clear, in this passage from Romans 13. Paul says, everyone must submit to governing authorities, for all authority comes from God, and those in position of authority have been placed there by God. So anyone who rebels against authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and they will be punished. So you have all of God's commands. Under that umbrella is every law, okay, every person that rules over you, okay, whether that be the president, your boss at work, okay, professor. And so unfortunately, if you don't like the rules, if you don't like your boss at work, if you don't like your professor, if you don't agree with the speed limit on 94, it's tough luck. Okay, this is actually a command from God, essentially. So you don't get to undermine it. You don't get to disrespect it. You don't get to oppose these rules. Okay, a recent example of this that was pretty clear, kind of revealed a lot of people's true colors on this issue, a lot of churches' issue, was during COVID. Okay, a lot of churches got into trouble during this time because, as you know, the CDC would not allow people to get together in large groups. And so a lot of churches disobeyed that. They went against it because they felt they had the right to do so. Okay, I know here in this church, in this house at Believer City, we took these very seriously. Okay, I was living here at the time, and I got COVID, and I spent 10 days in that room, only coming out to use the bathroom. Okay, I wore my mask in the bathroom. I think I took a shower with my mask on because I was paranoid. So we took it super, super seriously. And did all those guidelines make sense? No. Okay, and did we agree with all of them? Definitely not. But were they asking us to renounce our faith? Okay, were they asking us to stop praying or stop worshiping? No. Okay, they were trying to contain a pandemic. Okay, they were doing the best they could to contain it. Okay, people's lives were at stake, and I know that's one reason why we stood by it. And so a lot of churches went against it. Okay, a lot of them are still fighting legal battles and fines from what went on during that time. But you might be asking yourself, aren't we supposed to not follow the way of the world? Aren't we supposed to kind of stand out and be different? And I'm sure a lot of those churches felt that way. Okay, you got verses like 2 Corinthians 6:17 that says, therefore come out from among unbelievers. They come out from among unbelievers and separate yourselves from them, says the Lord. And Romans 12:2 says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. And so as Christians, our way of life is supposed to be countercultural. Okay, we're supposed to stand out. We should reject the same kind of thinking, the same kind of way of the world as unbelievers. But we are not called to open rebellion and chaos and just disregarding the laws. Okay, the world actually has plenty of that. Okay, the way of the world is to rebel in violent protests, in hateful speech, in just blatant disregard for society, for the laws. Okay, in a way, how we act countercultural is supposed to be countercultural. Okay, if that makes sense. How we stand out should look different than how the world tries to stand out. And we all live in America here, so there's not a lot of laws or regulations or persecutions that are going to keep you from doing the commands of God. Okay, you can live differently. You can stand out from the world just fine by following the laws. Okay, free to witness on the street, free to worship here openly. Okay, you can pray anytime you want. Okay, if you live passionately for God, if you're out there, that's going to stand out. That is going to be coming out from amongst the world. So you also might be asking, so when would it be okay to disobey the law? Okay, when is there ever a time where we should rebel, where we should not accept the authority in our life. It's a great example in Daniel's life. In chapter 6, there was a decree given that for 30 days, any person who prays to anyone, divine or human, must pray to the king, okay, the earthly king, or else he'll be thrown into the den of lions. And it says, when Daniel learned that the law had been signed, he went straight home, knelt down, and prayed, as usual. With his windows open, he prayed 3 times a day, just as he has always done, giving thanks to his God. Okay, that's a pretty clear example. Okay, if someone ever tells you, if there's ever a law that says, do not pray, except to our president, please don't follow that law, okay? You got to have some discernment. Okay, you got to have some good judgment here. Am I being asked to disobey? Am I being asked to cut off my relationship with God in any way? And notice that Daniel, if you remember, I guess, in Daniel, he does not obey the law, but he does submit to the consequence. Okay, he doesn't put up a fight. He doesn't try to run away. He gets thrown into the lion's den. Okay, he says, that's fine. I'll deal with the consequences. I'm not going to stop praying. And so Daniel still shows submission to authorities by doing this, and God takes care of him. But we're always to answer to God first. Okay, obey his commands and submit to your authorities. We'll pick it up here in verse 27. It says, then Jesus was approached by some Sadducees, religious leaders who say there is no resurrection from the dead. They posed this question, teacher, Moses gave us a law that if a man dies, leaving a wife but no children, his brother should marry the widow and have a child who will carry on the brother's name. Well, suppose there were 7 brothers. The oldest one married and then died without children. So the second brother married the widow, but he also died. Then the third brother married her. This continued with all 7 of them who died without children. Finally, the woman also died. So tell us, whose wife will she be in the resurrection? For all 7 were married to her. And Jesus replied, marriage is for people here on earth, but in the age to come, those worthy of being raised from the dead will neither marry nor be given in marriage, and they will never die again. In this respect, they will be like angels. They are children of God and children of the resurrection. But now, as to whether the dead will be raised, even Moses proved this when he wrote about the burning bush. Long after Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had died, he referred to the Lord as the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. So he is the God of the living, not the dead, for they are all alive to him. Well said, teacher, remarked some of the teachers of religious law who were standing there. And then no one dared to ask him any more questions. So here we have the Sadducees, okay, a little different group of teachers here. Now, this group does not believe in the resurrection, as it says. And so their question here about marriage in heaven, essentially, it's not because they're curious who their wife is going to be one day in heaven. They're trying to poke holes. They're saying, how do you handle this one in heaven, pretty much? And so they pose this scenario to Jesus of a woman who remarries 7 times, wondering whose wife she will be. Okay? Again, fair question. What does marriage look like in heaven? Well, firstly, real brief definition of marriage. Okay, this is between a man and a woman. Okay, they join together. Okay, it's the physical union. Okay, it's a sexual relationship between these two. They leave their parents and they start their own family unit. Okay, the Bible says that they become one. Okay, they kind of leave the home and start their own family. And Jesus tells them, marriage is for people here on earth. And those raised again will either marry or be given in marriage. Okay, so short answer, no marriage in heaven. Now, for those of you who are married, all, I think one of you tonight, too, that might be a hard pill to swallow. Okay, and I know a lot of you are in progress. Okay, you're planning to get married soon. Or many of you are looking forward to this. Okay, it can be a really hard thing to swallow. Okay, I get emotional if I think too much about it, so I'm not going to talk too much about it. But it's really hard to imagine. Too late. But look, what Jesus is really saying is that even one of God's greatest blessings. She knew this was happening. Even one of God's greatest blessings, okay? It pales in comparison. It pales in comparison to what we'll experience. Okay, well, our relationships here, yeah, they're limited by time, okay? They're limited by death, they're limited by sin. And in heaven, there's none of that, okay? So if you think about this, I'm confident that we'll be perfectly happy, okay, perfectly satisfied and not be married in heaven. Okay, maybe we can still be roommates. I think we can work the system. So with that in mind, okay, I'm confident that you can be perfectly happy, that you can serve God in your lifetime here and not be married. Okay, and this is tough, especially for some reason in Christian circles. Often marriage is put up on this pedestal, okay, of this ultimate human experience, okay, the best thing that you can have, that and having kids, having children. And a lot of people will think that without those two things, you can't be satisfied, that you're not living to your fullest. And I know that's not true, okay, that cannot be true. Okay, God can call you to have kids, God can call you to be married, and you should follow through on that calling, but not everybody needs to be married and have kids. And why do I think that's not true is because of this reason right here, because there's no marriage in heaven. If marriage and having kids was meant to be the best gift that God could give us, why would he withhold it in heaven? And why would he give us like this great, awesome thing and then just snatch it away in heaven, leaving us wanting more? Now, like I said, many of you are getting married soon. A lot of you probably will get married, and some of you won't. But don't ever think that this is some sort of lesser path for you or a worse experience here on earth to be married. Okay, God will use you, single or married, but it will look different. Okay, well, marriage opens up a ton of new experiences, a ton of new opportunities. It's great. You get to enjoy a lot of stuff that you didn't before. But at the same time, marriage also closes a lot of doors. And a lot of people don't realize that. Okay, it changes the type of relationships you have with everybody. Okay, with your single friends, everything changes a little bit. Okay, I'm not as close to a lot of guys that I used to be close with since I got married. I can't have a lot of the same kind of conversations or hangout times as I used to. Okay, you have a responsibility to the person that you marry. And that takes a lot of time, that takes energy, that takes patience, that takes a lot out of you to be joined together with someone. And yeah, you get a ton of blessings, okay? The scale's even, in my opinion. You decide to have kids as well. Okay, that responsibility just ups. That's like a whole nother level. Because now your number one ministry is also your spouse and your kids. Okay, that's always going to take your attention first. So as a single person, you can disciple, you can evangelize, you can serve in a lot of unique ways that I can't anymore, okay, that Abby can't anymore. I remember when I first started coming around to church, I was asking one of our pastors at Believer City, about how to stay pure, how to fight against lustful temptations and thoughts. And he gave me a ton of good advice. He talked about God's design for marriage, how putting that passion and desire in the right place is honoring to God, and I'll be satisfied if I just give that over to God. And I just remember sitting there thinking, this is real easy for you to say. Okay, you're married, you're experiencing all the blessings, like it already worked out for you. And so I thought it was a lot of great advice, but honestly, the best advice that rang true for me was that he told me that I should talk to my peers. He should talk to my other single friends who were also fighting that same thing. Okay, he could only take that discipleship so far in that moment. Okay, I had to go to other people who were more mature than me, but who were also living as a single guy at the time. Okay, so God will use you, married or not. Again, in the end, not even our earthly marriages will stack up against what God has in heaven. Let's touch on this last section too. He mentions that God is a God of the living, so that he is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Okay, not was. And again, I think he put it quite beautiful that God is a God of the living, not the dead. And so again, this is kind of his final refute to the Sadducees. Because again, remember, they don't believe in the resurrection. And Jesus is saying, nope, it's real. Okay, all these guys, all these ancestors, all these people that you would have read about in the scriptures, they're still alive right now with God. Okay, there is a resurrection. And maybe he made some progress because they said, you know, well said, teacher, and they didn't dare ask him anything else. Okay, so they had no real refute to that one. But let's read this last section, picking up now in verse 41. Then Jesus presented them with a question. Why is it, he asked, that the Messiah is said to be the son of David? For David himself wrote in the book of Psalms, the Lord said to my Lord, sit in the place of honor at my right hand until I humble your enemies, making them a footstool under your feet. Since David called the Messiah Lord, how can the Messiah be his son? Then with the crowds listening, he turned to his disciples and said, beware of these teachers of religious law, for they like to parade around in flowing robes and love to receive respectful greetings as they walk in the marketplaces. And how they love the seats of honor in the synagogues and the head table at banquets. Yet they shamelessly cheat widows out of their property and then pretend to be pious by making long prayers in public. Because of this, they will be severely punished. And so finally, Jesus turns the table on these guys. Okay, he asked them a question regarding David. Okay, if you don't know David, David is someone that these teachers would have looked up to. Okay, they would have held him in pretty high regard. He's one of their ancestors, one of the kings of the Old Testament. Okay, and he had a successful rule for a time, so he knew that these guys would respect what David had to say. So he says, how is it that the Messiah was to come from the line of David? Okay, how was he going to be a descendant of David? And yet David acknowledges the Messiah as Lord during his lifetime. Okay, how can he be both? Is pretty much what he's saying. See, the Pharisees' flaw, they have plenty of them, but one of their flaws here with how they saw Jesus was that they only saw the human element of the Messiah's coming. Okay, they mistakenly thought that the Messiah would be this conqueror, king, general, I don't know, who would just storm in and restore Israel to its greatness. Okay, they were hoping for the heydays of David and Solomon, and they thought, we're getting another king like that, okay? One that's going to slay giants, one that's going to conquer nations for us. So they only saw this human element of the Messiah, and they were missing the divine element. Okay, they couldn't quite put it together that Jesus was from heaven. Now, Jesus has always existed. Okay, it wasn't God that created Jesus and God that created the Spirit. Okay, they were all three. Okay, the Trinity was there from the creation of the world. Okay, the fact that Jesus had always been with God and Spirit since this beginning of time, and then that he also took on human form, they weren't connecting the dots. Okay, they repeatedly reject this idea that he was the Son of God. Okay, they thought because of this, all of his claims, everything that he's teaching, all these parables, everything that points to him being the Son of God, they just thought were bogus. Okay, they thought this is crazy. And that's why they keep on trying to get him arrested. Okay, that, and he was threatening how they did things. So Jesus, with all these guys right there, then turns to the crowd and says, hey, you guys need to watch out for these ones, okay? Watch out for your leaders here, because they love the attention and respect that you give them, but they're more interested in that. They're more interested in the benefits that they're getting than actually caring about the people. It says they'll rip off widows and then pretend to be righteous by praying long prayers in public. He's saying they're misaligned. Okay, don't follow these teachings that completely leave Jesus out of it. And so, like I said, the Pharisees, all sorts of wrong about things, mainly who Jesus was. Okay, like I said, they're like that big, beautiful building. Okay, perfectly functional for a long time. Okay, people accepted it, they used it, people looked at them, they thought this was it, this is how we live for God. But something was always off with that foundation. And so as we start to close tonight, again, hopefully you could look past all the questions, all the traps laid here, and look at how Jesus answers as a prompt to you tonight. Okay, where do you stand? What is it that you believe tonight? Okay, have you asked questions like this before? Have you thought of these questions before? And the most important one is Jesus your foundation? Okay, is Jesus that cornerstone that everything in your life is measured to him? Okay, everything that you do, everything that you think, everything you say, the way that you live, is it aligned with Jesus? Is it pointing back to Jesus? Okay, you can ask yourself this now, you can ask yourself tonight when you go home, but I would take some time, some quiet time, just to sit and think about this. And if it takes you more than 30 seconds, if you're like trying to make it be Jesus in your mind, he's probably not it. Okay, it's probably something else if you're trying to make it work in your head. So you got to know where you stand. And if I had to leave you with any lasting thought here is, if it's not Jesus for you tonight, then just say it's not Jesus. Okay, have an answer, unlike the Pharisees. Have an answer towards God on what you believe and where you stand. Okay, maybe you are unsure. Maybe you want it. Maybe you're near it. Maybe you're learning about it. But if you haven't fully committed, that's fine. But you got to be honest with that, about that with yourself. Okay, the worst thing that you could possibly do is convince yourself that you're good, that you already figured it out, that you don't have to make any further surrender, that you don't have to change anything. Okay, that's real dangerous. And that's, again, why Jesus says he'll spit you out if you're lukewarm. Okay, he'd rather have hot or cold. Because if you're cold, if you're saying it's not Jesus tonight, you have a chance. Okay, God can work with that. You can turn to him. Okay, so have an answer. Have an answer on that. Let's close. I'll pray.